So for this session, we will use a somewhat different format because the paper was not distributed. So Miriam is going to present her own paper, after which we will have the opportunity to all comment on it. Is that okay? And maybe you talk for about 20 minutes.
Well, thank you very much. I'd also like to thank both of the organizers for the invitation to this very exciting symposium. I trust you can hear me now. And I think that the last two sessions, in many ways sort of lay the ground to look at what happens when Islamic law becomes enforced and indeed becomes the basis for all public law, as was the case in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the last exchange that we heard between Karima and Nathan is interesting in that if Nathan's argument was, well, the family code in Egypt really is secular law because it's passed by a secular parliament, well, one can ask then, in the Iranian case, after the Expediency Council, which I will talk about more in a minute, it's basically a council that need not consist of clerical members. Since that council can overrule the Guardian Council, it is essentially a process by which a secular council also passes law. Does that mean what we really encounter now is secular law in the Islamic Republic? I would strongly disagree with that, but because not all state law is, just by virtue of being state law, secular law. But I wonder whether maybe we can discuss this further in the question and answer session. So I will try to multitask by using the computer and the PowerPoint slide. I was asking myself what kind of paper on the Islamic Republic of Iran contribute to a symposium that deals with constitutionalism in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. And if I were giving a talk to political scientists, I would highlight that in the constitutional history of the Islamic Republic in the last 32 years, really, the dominating trend has been one of centralization of power under the office of the supreme leadership. And one can make this argument, I think, beautifully, looking both at constitutional law, but also the way in which the supreme leader has increasingly regulated the sphere of religion, which ties up with our discussion of what secularism means or to what extent partnership between religion and state does not always square with democratic autocratic dichotomy. One could make that argument by looking both at the constitutional history and the extent to which the supreme leader has regulated the religious sphere over time. But what I really want to highlight, I think, in this context is rather what Islamic law has meant in the last 32 years and the transformation that it has experienced by being reinterpreted and being granted different statuses vis-a-vis secular law over time. I think if one looks at the Iranian constitutional process, first of all, one sees that already in 1979 it was a very open-ended process. The outcome was not at all predetermined. It could have very likely led to an outcome that would have been radically different. And I will discuss the first draft of the Constitution in a moment in comparison to the final draft that was then passed in 1979. I also think that the constitutional history shows a great degree of dynamism and responsiveness to sociopolitical and economic demands. It does not at all, I wouldn't like to give the impression that this means that it is necessarily a responsiveness to the people, citizens' rights, but it is a responsiveness to what is required really for regime survival. So part of the success, I think, of the Islamic Republic, despite the very severe crisis domestically and internationally it has faced in the last 32 years, is precisely its ability to adapt politically and constitutionally to diverse socio-political and security demands. I think one also sees, interestingly enough, a desire to formalize de facto changes in power relations, to formalize these in the constitutional text. One sees that with the amendment process and also an amendment discussion that is currently going on in Iran. So it is actually a loyalty, I think, to constitutional texts that one discovers, despite the fact that, of course, one sees transgressions of power and mandates all the time. But nevertheless, it's anything but a facade constitution. I think one really needs to recognize that the different councils and institutions in Iran do invoke the constitution all the time, and there's a constant debate over constitutional interpretation and reinterpretation that is going on. So it's not an ignorance of the constitution, but rather a process that takes the constitution very seriously. And then, as I hinted at just preliminary, I think the red thread that one does see in the constitutional developments is that there's been a centralization of power in the office of the Supreme Leader, and that's something I might go into more detail in the question and answer session. So what are the turning points of the constitutional status of Islam? The first draft of the constitution in 1979 actually did not incorporate the velayat-e faqih. The velayat-e faqih means guardianship of the jurist, a concept that signals that the highest religious authority of the country, the highest Shi'i jurisprudence, should also hold the highest political authority. That is the most important basis of government in the Islamic Republic since 1979. Interestingly enough, that concept was not part of the first draft. The first draft invoked Ayatollah Khomeini's writing on Hukumat-e Islami, which means Islamic government, and also consisted of a number of other important elements that would have not featured as high of an incorporation of Islamic law as the final draft did. The first draft of the constitution was submitted to Khomeini for approval, and he actually suggested that it should be submitted to the people in a popular referendum. And it is not because of Khomeini or clerical intervention, but because of leftist and constitutional liberal factions in the revolution that felt we really need to have an inclusive constitutional process. All factions that were participant in the revolution must be part of this, and therefore we should have popular elections for a constitutional assembly, which can then take this first draft, discuss it, and arrive at a final draft. What happened is that there were popular elections for an assembly of experts, a smaller council of 40 members, in which the clerical members had the majority, and that is when much more sort of dramatic elements of Islamic law were incorporated into the draft that then became the final draft and was then submitted for a popular referendum. This, of course, raises important questions of, well, what did Khomeini really have in mind when he sort of implicitly agreed to the first draft of the constitution, and why does it seem that he actually was not so adamantly insistent on clerical power as one would have the impression when one looks at the final draft? The second important turning point is the introduction of maslahat as a legal principle. This happens in 1988 when Khomeini argues that public interest can be invoked to overrule the Guardian Council, the council that decides over whether legislative bills are in accordance with Islamic law. This is the most important decree that Khomeini passed during his tenure as Supreme Leader between 1979 and 1989, that he reversed the hierarchy between secular and Islamic law de facto. He de facto argued that public interest can be invoked in order to overrule the Guardian Council's veto of legislative bills that was based on their understanding that a bill would not be in line with their interpretation of Islamic law. 1989 is another turning point then that institutionalizes the maslahat, because a council is instituted that is mandated with discerning what maslahat means. So a council is set up that is entirely appointed by the Supreme Leader in order to decide in which cases maslahat, public interest, can be identified to overrule the Guardian Council. In 1997, this expediency council, as it is usually called in English, then receives legislative power, meaning that apart from the parliament and the Guardian Council, it is now a third legislative power which also has initiative power. It no longer needs to wait for parliamentary drafts to be passed to it, but it can actually pass bills on its own. And then the final turning point, which we do not know yet whether it will become one, but there are discussions now underway for a second constitutional amendment process. So the first was in 1989, the only one so far. It's possible that the constitution will be amended once again in order to transform the presidential into a parliamentary system. Khamenei has suggested that the tensions between the presidential between the president and the parliament that have featured prominently in both of Ahmadinejad's presidencies, but also before and during Khatami's time, can best be dealt with by transforming the system really into a parliamentary one and having a prime minister rather than a president lead the executive. So, to elaborate a little bit on the two different constitutional drafts, both are based on the 1958 French constitution, which of course is interesting in itself. Why would a civil law constitution lie at the basis of a political system that is supposed to be based on Islamic law and will in some way or another entrench theocratic government? Well, the fact that it was embraced and the fact that it wasn't even questioned that a civil law system would lie at the basis of this legal system that was going to be Islamized, I think highlights the extent to which this was not a predetermined outcome. It was not clear at that time to what extent clerical authority would be part of the political system and the extent to which Islamic law would really be sort of the overriding source of law. What the first draft only hinted at was in Article 66 that the consolidated principles of Islamic law would be guideposts for legislation. So it's quite different from what we see in the final draft. There was full equality granted to men and women. It even allowed women to serve as judges and also to be judges of those realms of law that would be based on Islamic law, which of course is quite extraordinary. And this is the only clause that Khomeini objected to. So as I mentioned, the first draft, he agreed to the first draft and he suggested that it can be put forward to the people in a public referendum. This was the clause that he demanded should be changed. Women cannot serve as judges of Islamic law, which of course is very much in line with not only Shi'i but only also Sunni jurisprudence that women cannot serve as qadis. There were also amendment procedures part of the first draft, which was not the case anymore with the second. There was a guardian council instituted, so this was based on the French Conseil Constitutionnel, a council that could undertake judicial review, but only when requested by the president, the head of judiciary, or the public prosecutor. This was an 11-member council in this first draft, five mujtahids and six secular jurists. And again, as I mentioned, there was no mention of the guardianship of the jurist principle at this time. So it would have been the three branches of power, Article 66 saying that principles of Islamic law are the guideposts of legislation, but one can't really discern here how clerical authority precisely would have been part of this political system. And it also seems that Islamic law would have rather sort of been a philosophical principle that can be invoked and wasn't institutionalized because the Guardian Council did not have automatic judicial review over legislative bills, and also because the mujtahids were in the minority. So this radically changed with the final draft, when Veloyata Fakhi, the guardianship of the jurist, became the most important principle of government. So as I mentioned, the idea is that the highest Shi'i jurisprudential authority will serve as the highest political authority. The Wali, the supreme leader, sits above the three branches of power. In the 1979 constitution, the idea was that he negotiates and sort of mediates between the three branches of power. Only later on, after the amendment in 1989, did the position itself actually gain more power. So during the first decade, when Khomeini served as the supreme leader, it very much depended on his personality and how he filled out this position that on the paper did not have explicit intervention powers. Article 4 now of this final draft says all laws must cohere with Islamic law. The clause that granted equal rights to men and women is changed to say women and men must be equally protected before the law, so it's quite a different formulation. And as I mentioned, the clause that women could interpret Islamic law has been taken out. The amendment procedures were removed, which sort of is in line with the understanding of Islamic law that, the prevailing constitutional interpretation at that time that this constitution would not need to be amended, that the principles should not be changeable, and at the same time it should allow for enough flexibility to respond to diverse political and economic demands. And the most important change beside the Veloyata Fakhi principle is that the Guardian Council now is established with veto power over legislative bills, and that the mujtahids and the secular jurists are equally represented, 6 plus 6. The mujtahids are directly appointed by the supreme leader, and the secular jurists are appointed by the parliament, but based on a list that is submitted by the head of judiciary, who himself is appointed by the supreme leader. So it's a council that is highly sort of overdetermined by appointments directly and indirectly on part of the supreme leader. I would just maybe point out as a side note that this was in itself a revolution in Shi'i jurisprudence. The Veloyata Fakhi in classical Shi'i jurisprudence really meant that those who need legal representation should be represented by the clergy. So these would usually be widows and orphans. The 79 constitution radically reinterpreted this by expanding it to encompass guardianship over the entirety of society, not only those in need of legal representation, but everybody. It also elevated it, of course, from the private to the public sphere, and it concentrated this power in one individual, in the supreme leader, whereas the responsibility in the classical understanding of Veloyata Fakhi had been with the ulama as a collectivity, with the religious authorities as a collectivity. Now, as I mentioned, it is a very, very interesting constitution if one analyzes it closely, because it is an unprecedented attempt to build a system of public law rigorously based on Shiite law. In many ways, I think in hindsight, one can argue today that it was largely unsuccessful, because what happened with most of the most important bills is that one did, in the end, take the Pahlavi labor law, press law, and dotted it here and there with Islamic legal concepts, which made the interpretation more flexible, but didn't really transform it into something rigorously based on Shiite law, which may be an impossible task to undertake in the first place. The legislation of the parliament, now in the final draft of the constitution, needs the approval of the Guardian Council, and interestingly enough, the institution of the parliament itself is expressed as being contingent on the Guardian Council being in session. So the parliament itself doesn't really have a right of existence unless it is accompanied by the Guardian Council. So Montazeri, the two clerical representatives who fleshed out and formulated the concept of veloyat-e faqih in the constitutional process, and who represented Khomeini in this committee, were Montazeri and Beheshti. And Montazeri here comments on that relationship between the Guardian Council and the parliament. He says, if we want to follow the Islamic law, we must say that the enactments of the parliament are not legal and enforceable without the approval of the jurists of the Guardian Council. Obedience to religious prescriptions is incumbent upon everyone, whereas governmental enactments not endorsed by the mujtahids need not be obeyed. And I highlight this here also because, as I try to foreshadow, there's a 180-degree turn in 1988 against this hierarchy of law that is established here. It's of course very clear that Islamic law here is conceived as being superior to state law unless approved by the mujtahids of the Guardian Council, and this is then overruled in 1988. How much time do I have? I just wonder. Do I have 10 more minutes or not? Okay, well, if I do, then I might just highlight this, because we talked over dinner last night over the question of sovereignty. And this is quite interesting that there are two articles right behind each other in the Constitution. The Article 56, which allocates sovereignty with the people and derives it, of course, from God. Absolute sovereignty over the world and men belongs to God. And it then makes the jump to say that the people are to exercise this divine right. But then the next article already limits this, not explicitly, but in its implications. It says the powers of government in the Islamic Republic are vested in the legislature, judiciary, and executive powers functioning under the supervision of the absolute Wilayat al-Amr, the supreme leader, and the leadership of the Ummah, in accordance with the forthcoming articles and the constitution. These powers are independent of each other. I should highlight here that absolute was only inserted in the constitutional amendment in 1989. So at this point, it's still read just the supreme leader has supervision over the three powers. But of course, this already raises the question, well, if the people are sovereign, but the supreme leader or the branches of government function under the supervision of the supreme leader, then how really does this relate to popular sovereignty? Now, the most important elements in which this was based on the French model is that it was a semi-presidential system in the first 10 years with a prime minister and a president. So you de facto really had sort of two heads of the executive plus the supreme leader, three positions that could exercise executive power. The prime minister, who really had the most important managerial power, heading, of course, the cabinet, the president, who had some foreign policy functions and mandates, and the supreme leader, who interfered when there were tensions between mostly the legislative and the executive branch. The rights catalogue also was based rather directly on the French Constitution of 1958, freedom of assembly, association, media, the press, and the Guardian Council, as I mentioned, being modeled on the Conseil Constitutionnel, except that it was endowed with complete and preemptive screening power over all legislation, and that also then in 1992 onwards, very interestingly, the Guardian Council started to invoke the French model and argue, well, since the Conseil Constitutionnel really has the power to oversee the elections, we should have that too. It's quite interesting that in the framework of an Islamic Republic, you have a council invoking a secular French model in order to broaden its powers. Well, it was already in the constitution, but from 1992 onwards, they interpreted this more broadly. So the first step of screening is through the Ministry of Interior. But they then added in 1992 a step whereby each candidate is also tested with regard to his revolutionary credentials. So they could have done this earlier, but it's in 1992 that they started to interpret this in a rather maximalist way, their mandate to also oversee the elections. A few tensions here with regard to republicanism and Islam. So these are the clauses on civil liberties that are rather taken directly from the French model. Women and men are equally protected before the law. All human, political, economic, and social and cultural rights should be enjoyed by them. Publications and the press have freedom of expression. The formation of parties, societies, political and professional associations should be guaranteed. You see that with all of these provisions, important sort of addenda were added to these in the second draft, in the final draft of the 79 Constitution, which were not there in the first draft, that limit each of these clauses with reference to Islamic criteria, which are then supposed to be interpreted by the Guardian Council. So the Guardian Council is the locus of decision-making over what these Islamic criteria are and whether, in a certain situation, fundamental principles of Islam are being violated by certain publications or societies, political parties, and so on. The Islamic nature of the polity was enshrined, as I mentioned, in Article 4, that says laws must be based on Islamic criteria. Also that the majlis, the parliament, this is the Islamic Consultative Assembly, is the parliament, cannot enact laws against Islamic principles. What's interesting here is Article 167, which we also discussed over dinner briefly yesterday, that says in the case of the absence of codified law, the judge has to deliver his judgment on the basis of authoritative Islamic sources and authentic fatawa. So here the judge can sort of fill a void in positive law by inserting his understanding of Islamic law that have not yet found their integration into state law. And the final article of the Constitution says, this is Article 177, the Islamic nature of the system cannot be amended or changed in the Constitution. Now, 1988 is the important turning point. Interestingly enough, maslahat, public interest, does not have a history in Shi'i jurisprudence. It was a concept that Khomeini borrowed from Sunni fiqh. Usually Shia jurists dismissed it because it granted too much flexibility in the application of law. He invoked this in 1988, suggesting that it was justifiable to forgo Sharia in certain circumstances when the public interest or necessity so requires. Let me jump ahead to this slide here, because 1988 really followed on a number of steps that already tried to deal with the deadlock between the parliament and the Guardian Council. So really from 1981 onwards, the parliament, which was dominated by, if you will, crudely speaking, economic leftists, many of whom then became the reformers under the Khatami era, tried to pass a land reform that would have disenfranchised, or anyway, would have taken away much of the waqf land that was administered by the clergy. The Guardian Council repeatedly vetoed this bill. Both the land reform and then later the labor law reform were the most contentious bills between the parliament and the Guardian Council. The parliament didn't really get anywhere because the Guardian Council kept vetoing the bills and there was no mediation mechanism. So Rafsanjani, who later of course became president, was a speaker of parliament at that time and made a very interesting argument, which he called, with reference to fiqh puya, innovative fiqh, that there are emergencies when it must be possible to forego principles of Islamic law. So he argued in 1982, or actually already earlier, 81, that there must be cases where emergency can be invoked by the parliament that are then not subject to the veto power of the Guardian Council. Khomeini gave way to this with the emergency ordinances in 1982 that resulted in a new regulation whereby the Guardian Council, the faqis, the Islamic jurists of the Guardian Council, could not veto those bills that were passed with reference to zarurat, with regard to emergency. So only the secular jurists could veto this, and then only based on the justification that it was incompatible with constitutional law, but of course not with Islamic law, because they're not specialists of Islamic law to begin with. So that was an opening made in 1982. A second opening was made in 1987, when the concept of obligatory contractual conditions was sort of invented. This was in the framework of the labor law that was pushed forth and back between the parliament and the Guardian Council, whereby Khomeini decreed that there are certain contractual conditions, and here labor law should fall under this, that should not be that can be invoked with or without Islamic law, contract law, and the consequence, of course, here was that it can be invoked without Islamic contract law, meaning that the Guardian Council should not be able to veto this particular reform. So he broadened sort of the number of bills. First you had bills that could be passed with reference to Zarurat, and now it was with regard to obligatory contract law that could be passed and circumvent the veto of the Faqis in the Guardian Council. This then sort of climaxes in 1988 with Maslahat, with the acknowledgement of Maslahat, the Sunni fiqh principle, when Khomeini rules in another decree that there are certain situations where Maslahat can trump Islamic law. And he, in 1988, founds a council, initially only consisting of 13 members, called the Expediency Council, the Council to Discern What Maslahat Is, that is supposed to mediate in case of a deadlock between the Guardian Council and the Majlis. Now, if I just quickly go back to this, it could be, this council could be activated when two-thirds of the parliamentary deputies decided so. So after a bill was vetoed by the Guardian Council, it would go back to the parliament, and they could then, if there was a two-thirds majority in parliament, decide to pass this on to the Expediency Council, which is entirely appointed by the Supreme Leader. It must not consist of clerical authorities. He could, if he wishes, entirely appoint lay experts into this council, which can then overrule the Guardian Council. So it's a very important change in the hierarchy of law that took place at that time. The Expediency Council is formed, and this goes back to my earlier argument about sort of, I think, what one can see as a trend of also desired formalization of changes in power relations in the Islamic Republic. In 1989, the constitution is for the first time amended. The immediate background to this is that Khomeini, seeing that he will most likely pass away soon, convenes several committees that are supposed to work on changes to the constitution. Remember, there was an amendment process, but Khomeini initiates one nevertheless, and asks these different councils to deal with a number of deadlocks. The Parliament Guardian Council was one, but also the judiciary didn't work quite well because it was headed by a five-member Supreme Judicial Council that couldn't, that often wasn't capable of forming executive decisions. There were also the power quarrels between the Prime Minister and the President. So the constitutional amendment in 1989 deals with a number of sort of efficacies of the system, but also it deals with the whole succession problem. The issues here that have to do with improving the efficacy is that the position of the Prime Minister was done away with, so it became, from the semi-presidential, it was transformed at that time to a presidential system. The Supreme Council of the Judiciary was replaced by one head of judiciary who is now appointed by the Supreme Leader, and a National Security Council was created that is also appointed by the Supreme Leader that decides over foreign and security policy. One wanted to take that branch out of the parliament that was viewed as too radical by many. A number of other changes responded to the fact that Khomeini, that one looked for a successor. Khomeini had just dismissed his designated successor, Montazeri, who was, if you remember, sort of his representative in the 1979 constitution drafting process. There was a fallout. He was dismissed, and Khamenei, the now supreme leader, who was decided upon at that time to succeed Khomeini, lacked a number of requirements. He was not an Ayatollah, not a grand Ayatollah, certainly at that time. Marja is supposed to be a source of emulation, the highest Shi'i jurisprudential authority, someone that Shi'i believers are supposed to follow in his fatawa, in his recommendations on all sorts of issues, how to pray, when to start fasting, issues of hygiene, and so on. So a Marja, initially in the 79 constitution, was a requirement for serving as supreme leader. This was done away with in the constitutional amendment to pave the way for Khomeini being able to serve as a supreme leader, who was a rather mid-ranking cleric at that time. But at the same time, his office is endowed with more institutional power, if you will. As I mentioned, this adjective absolute is added to the constitution. The supreme leader now is not only supervising the three branches of power, he now has absolute power. The Expediency Council that was formed a year earlier is now also endowed with the mandate to advise the supreme leader, and it is given a guideline competence in policy issues. So the supreme leader is now endowed with a new council that is supposed to advise him and also be a player in the legislative process. And the president is made answerable to the supreme leader, here also establishing a clear hierarchy. Now, finally, and I think I am coming to an end soon, the just to highlight then two more quite important changes after 1989, after the constitutional amendment. One is that in 1997, the Expediency Council receives also the formal power to actually initiate legislation. It doesn't need to wait anymore for the Parliament to pass legislation onto it. It is expanded over time in membership, which speaks mostly to the fact that I think the Supreme Leader wants to sort of co-opt potential political opponents and appoints more and more people, broadens the base of this Expediency Council that is in many ways sort of now the locus of legislative power, if you will. And very interestingly, this has hardly been written about, the Expediency Council grants itself budgetary power over the Supreme Leader's office. The Supreme Leader's office is now based on a budget that is passed in the Expediency Council. Of course, all other budgets are supposed to be passed in the Parliament. That's the most important power that the Parliament has, the budgetary power. But the office of the Supreme Leader, from the early 90s onwards, is funded through a budget in the Expediency Council, which is not published. Nobody really knows how many thousands of or millions of rial, it must be millions or rather billions of rial, this amounts to every year. A number of institutions, of course, are controlled by the Supreme Leader, which then are also drawn from this budget or based on this budget. So he has his representatives in all the different ministries in the cabinet. He appoints the provincial governors. He also funds the cultural offices in all the embassies around the world, right? The embassies, of course, are directly answerable to the foreign ministry, except for the cultural offices in the embassies. So it's quite interesting if you ever engage with an Iranian embassy, you have to see whether it's the political or the cultural office you're dealing with. If you're dealing with the cultural office, you're dealing with the direct representatives of the Supreme Leader, which may be a different ballgame. And also the budget here finances the Special Court of the Clergy, which I just briefly mentioned also over dinner last night, which is a very interesting branch, not part of the judiciary, that is, whose main function is to prosecute digressions of the clergy, keep the clergy in check, as well as the Hausa Management Organization, which is a way to regulate and control the religious seminaries. So it's here the control over the religious sphere that draws its funding from the Expediency Council's budget. So it's a really quite important change in the political setup that took place in the early 90s. We can go into this in the in the question and answer session if we will. The process of constitutional revision is quite interesting because it's under discussion right now. So just to conclude, I think one does see a high dynamism and change in this constitutional environment. Yes, it is non-democratic, but it is also highly responsive to different needs of, I think, regime survival, again, if one wants to call it that. But it is coupled with these republican elements that are not purely symbolic. If I might just give one indication of this, the Special Court of the Clergy is based on an ordinance by the Supreme Leader that he decreed in the early 90s. Now, of course, the Supreme Leader's decrees are published. One can even follow them on a website. With this particular ordinance, because the institution is so precarious and I think so controversial, the Ministry of Intelligence, who drafted that code for the Special Code of the Clergy, inserted it into the Parliamentary Gazette, giving the impression that this was actually a code passed by the Parliament, right? In the Parliamentary Gazette, you can only see the bills that are passed by the Parliament, and they usually at the end have the stamp of parliamentary approval. So the code of the Special Court of the Clergy, based on the ordinance of the Supreme Leader, was inserted into the Parliamentary Gazette, lacking the stamp of the Majlis, in my interpretation, to give the impression that the Majlis was still somehow involved in the creation of the Special Court, which it was not at all. It never had a say in how the courts are set up and whether they should be formalized at all and so on. So it gives, I think, an interesting insight into the extent to which republicanism is, I think, taken seriously by many citizens, and the Supreme Leader is conscious of that fact. And he tries to portray a few of his decrees here and there as if they were outcomes of republican processes, or anyway, of decision-making processes that are located in these republican institutions that still do exist, the presidency and the parliament, that are based on direct popular elections. So it's not a purely symbolic principle. And I think with that, I will close.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for your paper and excellent presentation.